Hello and welcome to The Stooshy, the Scottish politics podcast from DC Thompson that helps you be better briefed. I'm Andy Phillip. On this episode, we're joined by the politician behind the third attempt to change the law in Scotland on assisted dying. The legislation is about to be formally introduced at the Scottish Parliament, and supporters think opinion in the chamber has finally shifted in their favour. Clearly, this debate is controversial, and it stirs up emotional reactions, as well as a more fundamental focus on the law and ethics. The latest Holyrood attempt comes as the rest of the UK is also taking a closer look once more. High-profile supporters include TV presenter and Childline founder Esther Ranson, along with British Bake Off judge Prue Leith. Liam MacArthur is a long-serving MSP who watched the first two attempts fail in Parliament. This time, he thinks they've got the safeguarding part correct, but will it be enough to convince the doubters, which include some medical professionals and influential faith groups? Liam recently travelled with a delegation to California, one of the states where the law has changed. He discusses what he learned there too. And we talk about the emotive experiences relayed by those left behind. Our titles, The Press and Journal, The Courier and The Sunday Post, have all reported in depth in recent months and years about how end-of-life care has shaped opinion. Reporter Justin Bowie spoke to Liam MacArthur as he prepares to publish the draft legislation. He began by asking if this will be third time lucky.
Well, I genuinely hope so. I think there's been a number of differences. Obviously, the last time we debated this issue and voted on it in the Scottish Parliament, it was back in 2015 when Margot MacDonald's bill was picked up by Patrick Harvey after she passed away, and obviously it fell at stage one on the general principles. I think since then there's been a number of factors that I think are worth bearing in mind. Firstly, we've had a couple of elections here in Scotland. So around two-thirds of the MSPs who are currently in the Scottish Parliament weren't around back in 2015, haven't had a chance to debate this issue or certainly to vote on it. I think since then, we've also seen quite a number of states and countries around the world introducing their own legislation are on the same kind of model as I'm proposing, a sort of terminal illness mental capacity model. And I think what we've also seen is a shift in terms of where medical opinion is. I think most notably, we see the British Medical Association moving from a position of opposition back in 2015 to one of neutrality. And I think that better reflects the breadth of views that that are to be found across the medical profession, as we find in the country at large. But yeah, the public have been, I think, overwhelmingly supportive of a change in the law for decades now. Anything north of 70% in poll after poll suggest they support a change in the law. But I think what we're now seeing on the basis of international evidence, a shift in medical opinion, and a lot of MSPs who come with their own personal experience of losing a family member or a close friend to a bad death, I think the political environment feels very different this time around.
I wanted to ask a bit about, you know, you talked about public opinion there. Are you confident that public opinion is on your side? And similarly, in the Scottish Parliament, are you confident that there's sort of shifting attitudes among some MSPs who in the past may have opposed this and may now support it? So yeah, I was wondering, what are your views in terms of where the public stands and where Scotland's politicians stand on this now?
I know it's problematic to rely too heavily on polls, but I think consistently for many years now, as I say, probably the best part of the last couple of decades, poll after poll has suggested an overwhelming level of public support for a change in the law. The specifics of that, perhaps not quite as clear, but I think a recognition that the current ban on assisted dying is unsustainable. It's leaving too many Scots at the end of life with an intolerable decision to take, a painful, bad, sometimes protracted death. If they've got the financial wherewithal and the physical capacity to make it to Switzerland, the option of going to Dignitas is there. But we know for a great many, the option that is taken is to take matters into their own hands, adding to the trauma experienced by them and those that they leave behind. So I think that the public attitudes to this are pretty clear, but I think it's taken a bit of time for the political mood to catch up with where that public has been for some time. From the conversations I've had with colleagues, as I say, I think many of them have their own personal stories, their own personal experience, and that's informing the way that they look at this issue. And if I think back to the consultation that I ran on my proposals back at the end of 2021, those personal stories came through to a far greater extent than was the case with either the previous bills that the Parliament's considered.
Yeah, I wanted to ask as well, obviously, given this has fallen by the wayside in the past, even though there is plenty of public support for it, what do you think stopped the bill from getting through in the past? And along those lines as well, is there anything specifically that, you know, you want to happen with this law that perhaps is different from before? You know, what different safeguards are you maybe proposing that weren't there before, for example?
Well, I think the reasons that it didn't pass previously, it's difficult to say, but I think there was a real apprehension that some of the concerns that were expressed that have been played out in those states and countries where the legislation has been passed and successfully and safely implemented, those concerns were perhaps uppermost in the minds of colleagues at the time. We never really got into a position, because the general principles weren't supported, we didn't get into a position where we could explore ways of addressing those concerns. I think the proposals I'm bringing forward this time round are highly safeguarded, but actually the eligibility criteria are as restricted as they possibly could be. I mean, you would need to have a terminal illness and mental capacity, the variety of safeguards over and above that, but those eligibility criteria are as tightly drawn as they possibly can be. I'm conscious that there are those who oppose any change in the law, but at the same time there are others who will feel that what I'm proposing doesn't go far enough. But I think I think this terminal illness mental capacity model that we've seen introduced in a dozen or so states in the US, more recently in all of the states in Australia and in New Zealand, is a model that's demonstrated that it can be introduced safely and successfully. It commands public confidence, and I think is the best way of ensuring the broad cross-party consensus that these proposals will need to secure if they're to pass this time round.
Some of the concerns that are brought up by opponents of assisted dying primarily include things like they worry that older, vulnerable people might be coerced into opting for assisted dying. They may feel like they're too much of a burden on their family, and concerns are often brought up from other countries that have assisted dying laws. Canada, for example, has recently paused an expansion to its assisted dying laws, and there have also been concerns in Belgium due to a rise in the number of people opting for assisted dying. Do you think the worries of opponents are reasonable, or what would you say to those concerns, and what would you say to the concerns that have emerged from countries such as Canada or Belgium?
We'll take that last point first. I think there are no two laws introduced anywhere in the world that are exactly the same, but they fall into two broad categories. The terminal illness and mental capacity model, which was first introduced in Oregon back in 1996, which is now replicated in, as I say, about a dozen states in the US and more recently in Australia and New Zealand. That's the model I'm looking to take forward. And in all those jurisdictions, there's been no expansion of the eligibility criteria since those laws were introduced. You also have a more expansive, permissive model that we've seen in operation in Benelux and more recently in Canada, which as I still commands the support of the public in those countries, and as was felt to be right for those countries, but is a very different model. And we've never seen any expansive model that's retreated into a terminal illness mental capacity model, but we've seen no examples of a terminal illness model that has morphed into a more expansive and permissive one. So this notion of the slippery slope has been debunked. I think the House of Commons Health Committee last month concluded exactly that. I think those concerns, so I understand them. We are having a debate that has been had in those other states and countries that have introduced a law. We need to go through that process. People do need to be reassured that the safeguards will do what they need to do while still providing choice for those who are eligible. In the vast majority of cases, palliative care and other types of care will be sufficient to meet the needs of patients. But in a small but still significant number of cases, we see all too often that people are left in intolerable positions, either enduring protracted, undignified, sometimes painful, although pain can often be managed, but undignified deaths that are traumatic for them, but equally traumatic for those they leave behind, whose abiding memory then is of the way in which that person died. And we're also failing very many of those terminally ill Scots who we know choose to take matters into their own hands and either starve themselves of food and liquids or take even more drastic action. And again, the trauma on them and those they leave behind indicates that doing nothing in relation to this has consequences, that the ban on assisted dying is unsustainable. We can and we must do better. And we now have so much international evidence that demonstrates how this can be done.
You mentioned palliative care there. Some of the opponents of assisted dying laws argue that we should improve palliative care and end-of-life care in Scotland, and that that should be the priority instead of moving towards a model where assisted dying is allowed. What would you say to that? I mean, you obviously hinted there at the fact that in some cases you don't feel palliative care can do enough, but is there a way where we can improve end-of-life care so that can work, or do you just think there's some cases where it just isn't enough?
I think both of those things are true. I mean, I stand in lockstep with those who are advocating for an increase in investment in and access to palliative care. I think the palliative care we have in this country is excellent, but there are still issues around access to it. But I think this is not an either or. It is about the range of choices that are available to people at their end of life. And for the vast majority, palliative care will be sufficient. I mean, it is interesting to note that in those countries, those states and countries where assisted dying has been introduced, the vast majority of those who seek to access this choice of an assisted death are in palliative care. Certainly over 80% seems to be kind of routinely the percentage quoted. Now, at the same time, you've got routinely around 30% of those who apply for an assisted death not ultimately using it, because either palliative care provides what they require right up until the end, they die quicker than they were expecting, or they change their mind. Having the choice of an assisted death, knowing that if it all gets too much, that option is available to you, in of itself has a palliative effect. It allows people to live their final days or weeks to the full, safe in the knowledge that that option is available to them. And again, harking back to the report from the House of Commons Health Committee last month, it found that the international evidence shows that where you introduce laws of this kind, invariably what you see is an increased investment in and improved access to palliative care. And that doesn't surprise me from what I've observed over the last 2-3 years.
Mentioning other countries and other models which exist, you, of course, were abroad yourself recently on essentially a fact-finding mission to look at these other models that exist in countries like, you know, the United States and various states over there. So how was that trip abroad? And would you say that it sort of strengthened your position on assisted dying?
I mean, it certainly reinforced the long-standing position I've had in support of a change of the law. What was interesting for me was I was accompanied by three colleagues from each of the other main parties who, by their own admission, would say they're undecided, conflicted on what to do on this issue. And I think watching them react to the responses they were getting to the very legitimate questions and concerns that they were exploring, I think was fascinating for me. I don't know where they now currently stand on the issue, but I think they will have found it helpful. We spoke to legislators who are in the same position as we are now. We were in the same position as we are now back in 2015, 2016. Ahead of the legislation being introduced and passed in California, going through the same debate as we are going through now. We spoke to medics who talked about that experience of going from a position where something was illegal one day to being legal the next day, and how you get up to speed to make sure that the service that's provided to patients is of the highest possible quality, and talking also about the impact it has on the relationship between medic and patient. And I think without exception, they talked about how liberating it was to have those very frank, open discussions about the range of options that were available and providing the sort of support that up until that point they hadn't been able to provide in those sort of final days and weeks. And then speaking to patient groups and to family members of those who'd accessed an assisted death, and who talked about how the process itself was so supportive, allowed their family members to have a degree of control at the end, a degree of choice and dignity, and that that process of dying being far less traumatic just allowed then the grieving process that inevitably follows to be less difficult, less traumatic for those that we leave behind. I mean, a lot of the focus is on the individuals who access an assisted death, and absolutely rightly so. But we shouldn't lose sight of the impact that these difficult deaths invariably have on surviving family members or friends groups who have to stand by and watch powerless as these final days and weeks take a toll on the person they love.
On that very subject, I think one thing that's notable is there's maybe plenty of people out there who haven't necessarily thought much about assisted dying until it's touched either them personally or somebody close to them. Is this a topic that has affected you personally in the past, or is it just something that, you know, you're very passionate about anyway and that you've kind of always felt needs to be changed here?
It's very much the latter. I mean, I have to say, over the last 2-3 years, I felt a bit of an outlier because I seem to be one of the few people that doesn't have that personal experience of losing a family member or a close friend. I'm now so well aware of so many stories and those who maybe are two stages removed from me in terms of having lost a loved one, that in a sense it's reinforced the commitment I've had to the need for a change in the law. But as I say, from back when the proposals were being consulted on and the overwhelming number of personal stories and personal testimonies that came in response to that consultation, then to the discussions I've had over the last couple of years with people who are desperate to tell their story, either those with a terminal illness or those who have lost a family member or friend in very difficult circumstances, who want to ensure that this debate is informed by those stories, who are, I think, desperate to see improvements made in the access to palliative care, but who recognise that despite the best efforts of palliative care, it will not be sufficient in every instance, and that additional choice of access to an assisted death is needed to provide dignity, compassion at the end of life for, as I say, a small but significant number of Scots who I think are being let down by the current ban on assisted dying.
Listeners will perhaps be aware that across our various news titles, we've written a number of stories about those who have been impacted by assisted dying. Earlier this month, we spoke to a Brough man, Alan Scott, in the Courier. His wife, Claire, travelled to Switzerland to die. We also spoke to Fort William teacher Susie McAllister about why she wants to see the law changed following the death of her husband Colm. These are stories that you will no doubt be aware of, Liam. You'll have read them. I was wondering what your thoughts have often been when you read about these harrowing cases and what a change in the law would mean to these families should it pass this time.
I'm enormously grateful to Alan and Susie and many like them who've come forward to tell those personal stories. I'm sure it can't have been easy, although in most instances there's a real steely determination that what they have gone through, lessons need to be learned from that and change needs to happen. Both Alan and Susie were very explicit about that in the interviews that they've given. But their experience, I suppose, highlights different consequences of what the current ban on assisted dying in Scotland means. In Alan's case, his wife was in a position to go to Switzerland to access assisted dying, in the sense assisted dying is available in Scotland, but only if you have the financial resources and the physical capacity and wherewithal to get to to Switzerland. But we shouldn't be outsourcing this. This should be an option that is available to Scots here in Scotland, not least because, as I say, it then isn't just the preserve of those that have the financial means. And it also means that individuals are able to spend more time living their life with their family, with their friends, etc., rather than having to constantly think about getting to Switzerland and how soon they would have to do that before they would lose their physical capacity. And in Susie's case, I think it's heartbreaking what she went through with her late husband and the trauma that both endured. I think Susie makes that point very, very powerfully about the impact of that experience in the final days. And I think last fortnight was particularly harrowing. And that leaves its scars. It will take many years. Possibly she may never recover from what she went through in those final 2 weeks. And as she herself says that she would have given anything to be able to prevent her husband going through those last 2 weeks of horrendous pain and indignity. So yeah, I mean, I think those cases illustrate, I think, very well the unsustainability of the current ban on assisted dying and why a change in the law is so desperately needed.
That was MSP Liam MacArthur talking to Justin Bowie about his assisted dying legislation. We'll be back next week for more. Until then, pick up a paper or log on to the Press and Journal, the Courier, Sunday Post, and all of our news brands so that you can be better briefed.